Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Exactly what it sounds like. Prince at a piano with a microphone. He recorded it in 1983, and it ultimately went into the vault at Paisley Park. Piano and a Microphone 1983 is the first of the standalone albums to be released in the wake of Prince's death. This hour, two guests to consider the music, but also the meaning of this release. And I hope you have some thoughts on this. I bet you do. How are you balancing the gift of new music from Prince with the knowledge that he hadn't intended to put this recording out into the world, at least not this soon? The gift versus the intentions of the artist. That's what we're talking about this hour, and I'd love your thoughts on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR. Jim McGuinn is in the studio with me. He's program director for 89.3 The Current. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Ah, thanks, Carrie.
And Zahir Ali is an oral historian, an admirer of Prince's art. And he teaches a U.S. history course at NYU titled Prince, A Sign of the Times. And he joins us from New York. And Zahir, I'm so glad we had to reschedule the show. So glad you could do this. Welcome. Good to have you on the show.
I'm so happy to be able to join you, and I'm a big fan of The Current, so honored to be on with Jim.
Jim loves to hear that. I thought we would play another song, 17 Days, off of the album, and then consider the mechanics of the recording and what we hear in this. So let's listen.
You turn the lights down so you can hear. Yesterday, you answered your phone. Matrix, knowing that your problem wasn't alone. Turn the voice down a little. Wanna call you every day, beg you to be near me. I know your head is underwater. I doubt that you could hear me.
Okay, how often do we hear the artist directing the turn the lights down, turn the voice down a little bit, right in the middle of making that incredible music? Zahir, what do you think that brings to it?
What I really appreciated about this was the physicality that comes through. In his produced recordings, there's a kind of flattening of the movement that is involved in the production of the sound. And you really hear Prince coming down heavy on the one beat with that key. You hear his foot tapping. You almost can imagine him dancing in his seat while he's singing. And so this is something that doesn't come through in the release version, which is a kind of two-dimensional representation of this experience.
That's a really great point. I don't often think about what the artist was doing when they were making this mm-hmm. music, but that kind of spontaneous direction gives us a glimpse into that.
I think it was Lisa Coleman in the liner notes talked about how when Prince approached the piano, he started playing it before he played it. Like his body was like, he would start getting into the rhythm and shaking and stomping his feet before he hit the keys. And that's a little bit of what you can feel in that recording.
That's right. So I can't hear the toe tapping, but I can kind of feel it. Let's listen. Jim, as you understand this, it is as it sounds, right? It's him just at a piano in his studio, and what else?
Yeah, well, at that time, he had a studio in the basement of his house. This wasn't Paisley Park
yet.
This is earlier.
Got it.
This is pre-Paisley Park.
Oh, wow.
So it was the house he was living in. I believe it was in Chanhassen as well.
But
And he had sort of the recording set up in the basement, but the piano was in the living room. Upstairs, so he had kind of an intercom going on with the engineer that's down in the basement and tracking this. But this is just, you know,
okay.
The way
so
he
when we
piano.
Hear him saying "turn the voice down," he's probably on the intercom.
Well,
the engineer could have
heard him through the microphone, and is probably but... you know. So this is clearly not anything that was ever intended to be released. This is just, you know, him working stuff out.
And yet it sounds so good
to
hear. I had no idea he was just in his house on one floor of his house.
Yeah, this is the Kiowa Trail house, the infamous purple house that had the gates with the peace sign and the love sign on the metal gates. You know, this is this album as it is now actually circulated for many years as a bootleg called Intimate Moments or Eavesdropping on Intimate Moments, and this is exactly what it feels like, that we're eavesdropping on these intimate moments that Prince is having, even though he isn't recording for a release. He's really putting his all in into this performance. It's almost, you know, that he doesn't need to have the full audience there to do a full performance. This is not a lackluster delivery. There are moments in this recording where there's a high level of energy. The vocals are, you know, very strong, and it's clear that he isn't just like, oh, let me just sit down and tinker on this piano and ho-hum through this song. You know, you're really getting this full-on performance, and you get a sense of that was what went into his work ethic as he practiced.
I wish more artists would let us hear this, because there might be a little bit of a lack of polish, but everything we gain because of that is so important. Maybe I think that just because it's unusual and most artists don't do this.
Well, there's, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the estates and the vault, because there's really, I think of it as three different categories of all the Prince music that we're about to, you know, hear in the coming years. There's so many live concerts, and you know, clearly this was one of the best live performers in music history, right? And there will be many opportunities, I hope, to be able to hear different tours and different points in his evolution as a live performer with his different bands. There's the sort of like the outtakes, the finished things that have been rumored, or maybe people on the deep internet have heard before, but most of us haven't gotten to hear complete songs or complete even albums maybe. And then there's things like this, which are, I would call these just the demos. And to me, this is the really illuminating kind of music is when you get to hear, you know, it's only about a minute and a half, but Purple Rain, hearing a snippet of Purple Rain that makes the hair raise, you know, to think about that maybe this is before the bands even heard Purple Rain. Maybe this is the first time it's ever been played on tape.
Let's hear it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All
right. Enough talking. Let's hear Purple Rain.
Thank you.
never meant to cause you any sorrow. Never meant to cause you pain. No one will want to see you laughing. No one will see you in the rain. Purple.
So Zahir, what's, and that's about it, because it's a short version of it. Zahir, what's revealing to you about the way Prince is using his voice and what he's doing with the lyrics there?
I think this is where you really get the emotion that he wants to put into the song. You hear him going into the light falsetto. You hear him going into this deep blues. It's really, you get to hear the song in its gestation. And, you know, to Jim's point, like you, this is like peering into a painter's sketchbook or a novelist's notebook. You get to see and actually witness how Prince is working on keys. He's reaching for notes. He's trying to see if they work.
Right.
You know, these chords, is this the sequence he wants? Like, you really get a sense of the intentionality in Prince's work. You know, we have this idea, because he was such an exceptional artist and he performed in such a way that it made it just seem like these songs just dropped out of heaven and just channeled through his body. But you really understand that he was a working artist. And, you know, this was a working session for him to work through some of his musical ideas. And that really comes across in even this little snippet.
Zahir, you've said something that kind of sent a light bulb off on me, because I interview a lot of writers. And what I'm always trying to do, especially with the fiction writers, is learn about the process, because the creative process is always mysterious. And if I could open a notebook in some ways and see that, I'd understand it. And that almost never happens.
Yeah,
and that's what's you've nailed it. That's what's really unique about this.
Yeah, you know, if you talk to writers and you ask them, like, how do you get your ideas? A lot of people think you have to form your ideas before you start writing. And they're like, no, I write to figure out what I want to say.
That's right.
And this is Prince playing to figure out what he wants to play, you know. And I think that you really get that sense from this release.
Yeah, most writers recoil when they hear that. Where do you get your ideas?
Yeah.
But no matter how many different ways you try to ask about the creative process itself, a lot of writers dodge that.
But in high school, we had little outlines, right?
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Most of them don't follow that. Hey, if you've just tuned in to the conversation, Jim McGuinn with us from 89.3 The Current, and Zahir Ali with us, an oral historian and a lecturer at NYU and a big admirer of Prince. We are listening to the songs from the first album that's come out of The Vault, Piano and a Microphone, 1983, and digging into what we hear and making some conclusions, I guess, from that. And if you're listening along with us this morning, I'd like to know how you're balancing the gift of having more music from Prince with this idea, with this knowledge that Prince did not intend for this music to come out, at least right now. So how do you balance the two of that, the two of those ideas, as you listen to the conversation and the music? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR. Andrea says, it's a bit unsettling, since it's no secret Prince would never have allowed this kind of use of all of his creative masterpieces. And then there's Karma. He might have the last word after all.
Hmm.
Jim, what do you make of that?
I'm on the side of, like, you know, it, as long as the people that are sort of curating the vault and the estates do do it in a way that is respectful and tasteful, and that I'm okay with it. And in fact, I, you know, both the things that I've learned in the last couple of years from meeting people that worked with Prince, whether they were bandmates or whether they were, you know, graphic designers or, you know, cooks at Paisley Park, it has only grown my sort of respect for him as a human and an artist, because we have gotten to see a little bit behind the curtain. And that's, to me, what this is just more of. This to me is, I cherish this record already more than, you know, some of the stuff that's already come out that's been outtakes or rarities and stuff like that, because it does feel it does feel intimate, you know, but I appreciate that a lot.
Are you, and of course you're speaking as an admirer and a fan of his music, are you also recalling, I mean, he was a control freak about his music. I mean, how do you weigh, and I, as the artist, didn't think this was ready, or I would have put it out.
But he did put it in the vault. And you know that the last 30 years have seen a lot of, you know, like the CD boom brought the box set to the fore with a lot of like demos and outtakes and rehearsal performances. And a lot of artists have opened up. And Prince, you know, several times over the ensuing decades put out, he did pull things out of the vault on occasion. So whether he would have ever gotten to this performance in his lifetime, if had he lived, it is unknown.
Let me grab a call to Carter in Brooklyn Park. Hi, Carter. Glad you heard the show. What are you thinking?
Oh my gosh. If you just take it as what it is, Prince was a genius. And if he could make sure that there was no will and he could just leave the world wondering, we'll talk about his albums forever and what he would have thought about it. And who would have better? I'm like, he's in heaven going, I got you.
So you agree with this idea that Prince is getting the last word?
Oh my goodness, can you imagine? Because if he had said, there's a will and these people are entitled to my final legacy, he would have had the last word and helped Prince to see. Now he just leaves it up for interpretation. He's a freaking genius.
Zahir, what do you think of that logic? I'm hearing that idea on Twitter, too.
Well, you know, I, as a researcher who depends on archives, this is how I see this recording. This is an archive. And we look at people's journals that aren't intended for public. We read letters that aren't necessarily intended for more than the recipient. And we use that as the basis to reconstruct the past. And I think this is very much that kind of document to me. You know, this Prince, he nodded. You know, he knew that these songs had been bootlegged, these releases had been bootlegged. A few times he would play a song that hadn't been released and the audience would respond knowingly. And he would stop and say, "What y'all know about that song?" And, you know, he knew. He was in a kind of playful way. I mean, obviously, he worked very hard to protect his intellectual property and his legacy. And I think he was a perfectionist and he held songs until he felt they were ready. You know, Strange Relationship, which is on this release, doesn't come out for another 4 years, right? So that he was very intentional about when he wanted to release things. But now that he's not here, and I think it's important for us to take a full accounting of his legacy and his mastery. Many people know him as a guitar player and not as a piano player. And also his engagement with different music styles. You know, you have something on here like Mary, Don't You Weep, and we knew that Prince had these religious leanings, but this is like a deep spiritual gospel song, and he performs it in full spirit. And just to be able to hear him do that, and do this in 1983, when he was on the cusp of being like a pop icon, and his deep connection to the kind of roots of his music, I think is important for us when we reconstruct, you know, who Prince was and where he actually came from.
Let's cue up Strange Relationship here, and I'll grab a call while we do that to Sarah in Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah. How are you feeling about this?
I'm feeling really torn. I love hearing it, but there's a part of me where my heart is being so protective of him. I feel like I'm kind of looking into places where I'm not really sure he wants us to go yet.
Good point. And does that feel transgressive in some ways?
Yes. There's his death was really not that long ago. And the way that he slowly pieced out releasing these, I get a little nervous that it's too close to his loss. And I wonder if he's looking down on us, going, "Hey, shame on you guys. Slow this down."
I appreciate the call, Sarah. If you've just tuned in, we're playing music from Prince's album, A Piano and a Microphone, 1983. Here's Strange Relationship.
Oh, what the hell? Oh, surrender. What's the strange relationship that we hold on to? Honey, I just can't stand to see you happy. Baby. Bet your wishes was a movie, then you could rewrite my every line. Oh, baby, I'll take the blame, girl, but I want you to know I didn't like it, baby, I had to make it mine. But I just can't stand to see you happy, yeah, and to see you sad.
Jim? We'll let this play a little bit underneath us. This is my favorite song from this. I just love this. I love the jazzy and the the improvisational kind of feel to this.
Yeah,
this ended up on an album in 1987.
Yeah, is that right? The Times.
Does this sound?
It's similar but different.
Okay, I mean, you know, how so?
You know, by the time he got there, I think, as Zahir was saying, you know, the final performances maybe were flattened out. You lost some of this sort of really raw spontaneity that's going on here as he's like trying things out. And by then he's developing these tracks in the studio with a lot more of a meticulous sort of eye to things. But, you know, I had a conversation with Bobby Z yesterday from The Revolution, and he was psyched that this is out and that people are getting to hear what he got to hear every day. You know, he said this is what it was like, you know, going over to the house or showing up for band practice. It would be, here's another batch of songs. He's like, we'd watch. He talked about, you know, we being in a hotel room on tour, and they saw an HBO thing on Nostradamus, and the whole band was like, wow, that was really cool. And Prince shows up, and he had written 1999 after watching that special.
Wow.
You know, and so for him, he was like, it's cool that people are going to get to hear this music.
We should say you had a pretty lengthy conversation with Bobby Z.
Yeah, actually,
are we going to get to hear some of that?
Friday on our Purple Current stream, Bobby Z is going to come in and co-host the Purple Hour and talk a lot of stories about Prince, and then he's going to come back again a couple times throughout the month on Teenage Kicks on the Current and on Purple Current in the next couple of weeks. So if you want to really dig deep into this stuff, we're going to have some great opportunities to take that dive with someone who was there with Prince side by side for so many years.
Let me grab a call here from Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom, hi. What are you thinking about as you listen to the music?
Well, I'm just curious about people talking about, you know, they're happy with them releasing stuff that he may not want to release. And I'm wondering how you know what his thoughts were on this music. And I'm assuming he probably had different attitudes towards different pieces. I know in the classical music world, there's stuff published posthumously for a variety of reasons.
Yeah,
you know, one, it wasn't finished. They couldn't get it to the publisher. Sometimes it's written just for an individual that they wanted this individual to hear it only, very personal. So how do you know what his attitude was towards these different pieces?
Zahir, do we have some insight on how Prince felt about the stuff that was in the vault?
Well, we know that he was a perfectionist because even when he would release live versions of his performances, he would sometimes go into the studio and overdub parts that he felt needed to fill out. You know, he did this for his only live release, which was from his One Night Alone tour. And he gave this, I remember he gave this this blistering guitar solo and he performed Joy in Repetition live here in New York, and it was used in the release. But he went into the studio and did some things to the vocals. You know, he wanted to fill out some things here and there. And so knowing that that's how Prince approached his releases, he was very much a perfectionist, and he would... I don't think he would want raw versions of his music coming out. But again, you know, that's while he's here, right? Like, mm-hmm. while he's here, I would understand that, because he's like, I gotta, you know, I'm still a working artist, and I still have a standard that I have to maintain. And I don't think anything that we've gotten, and certainly not in this release, detracts from the regard that people hold him as an artist. Like, there are released, like, 40 released recordings while Prince was with us that can testify to his, you know, abilities as a pop musician or as an R&B or a rock musician. Now we are getting a chance to really discover who was behind that. And I think these kinds of releases help us really understand the journey to the songs that we ended up hearing.
Jim, did you say a few minutes ago that you trust the executors of the estate and the people that are making this decision to treat the vault with care and make the right decisions? Did I hear that right or no?
Well, I think it's, you know, fingers crossed. You know, there's been some examples. I think Jimi Hendrix's legacy was kind of not handled well in the 70s. There were a lot of half-finished records that were then overdubbed, you know, far from his direction. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. those records were criticized pretty roundly. And we haven't seen anything like that going on at this point. And I think that the first thing to come out of the vault. And I think that they're going to they've learned from some of the historical mistakes that have been made with some of the artists' legacies when they've passed on. And, you know, like I said, fingers crossed, they're going to do a good job. And so far, I believe in what they've done.
Zahir, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, same thing. Fingers are crossed. I think Prince has such a commanding story, and even in his unfinished work, that is sufficient. And what I really appreciate of what I've read of interviews with Michael Howe, who's the archivist who's working with these recordings, he's approaching this, I think, with that kind of care and concern of, you know, like, they restored as much of this recording as they could, but the tape hiss is still there. And I appreciate that. There are people who are like, this is not good quality sound. And I'm like, it was recorded onto a cassette. What do you want? And, you know, I actually appreciate that, because that time stamps it. That helps us historicize this recording. And I think it's important for us to keep it in its context.
John Munson is listening in, musician, the New Standard, Semisonic, a number of other bands. And he's got a good question for you guys. Do artists always know what's best to put out? Sometimes I wonder.
Mm.
Jim?
Hmm.
Should it always?
That's a great question.
It's a good philosophical
Thank you, John Munson.
I
think it's really hard when you're that close to the work, because you are impacted by the context of what's going on in the moment. Sometimes you're impacted by the context of what's going outside of you in the moment, and you may not always have the clearest view. And sometimes in hindsight, you know, it is interesting, because I have found already, just in the couple of years since Prince's passing, that his music sounds different to me now. And there was a point in time where he was obviously in sync with pop culture throughout the entire 1980s, right?
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
there was a point where he kind of wasn't in sync with pop culture. And a lot of people thought, oh, maybe his work isn't as good. And now I think we're kind of reevaluating some of that stuff from the late 90s and early 2000s and going, no, there's great stuff here. It just wasn't mm-hmm. really locked in sync with what was going on elsewhere, but that's okay. Looking at his career as a whole, there's some great stuff. And we're going to find a lot of tracks that I think were left beside by Prince as he was moving so fast and he was always moving forward. And we're going to come back and probably find some great gems over the coming years.
Zahir, what do you think?
I think so. I think, you know, a lot of people are introduced to Prince when he was at his commercial peak, so they understood him as a commercial artist. But I don't think Prince always saw himself that way. I think he saw himself as an artist, and he recorded what he felt. He released what he felt. He gave what he felt. And if it didn't sell, okay, but that's still what he felt. And I appreciate, I think, as to Jim's point, that we can go back to, say, 1996 or 1998 or 2001 or 2003 and have a document of what Prince felt, because he felt confident enough to make that statement. He didn't sit and listen to someone saying, don't release it. You know, we have it. And I think I appreciate understanding Prince in that way.
Zahir Ali, Jim McGuinn, talking about Prince and the new album Out of the Vault. Thank you.
Mama, Mama, what's this strange change? Mama, why the butterfly?
You're listening to a song from Prince's album Out of the Vault, Piano and a Microphone, 1983, Zahir Ali, Jim McGuinn, considering the music with me this morning, and you too, as you think about how you balance the gift of new music from Prince and the knowledge that he wasn't ready to put it out.
You know, can I say something about the track that's playing now?
Sure, Zahir.
That is the one track on the whole release that I was uncomfortable listening to.
Why?
Because it sounds, you know, as the vulnerability of Prince is laid bare in that track. You know, trying to understand what he's singing about, there's this one part where he says, you know, what's this shaking? And I remember hearing Prince in an interview talk about having seizures as a kid, and I wondered if that was what this song was about, because he's pleading with his mother. He's asking, what is this strange feeling? What is this shaking? You know, why the butterflies? You know, the anxiety. And then he says, where is father? You know, we know that his parents divorced or separated. And so this was the one song on the whole release package that I felt like this was deeply, deeply, deeply personal, and I wondered if I was really supposed to be hearing this.
Jim?
It's an amazing performance and song, and the thing that it made me wonder about is, you know, this is the time frame when he's working on what would become Purple Rain, both the movie and the album, and there's maybe
a
little
autobiographical.
Bit of, yeah, there's maybe a little speculation that this song would kind of be the genesis for When Doves Cry, which is a song that kind of brings that all together and talks about the parental relationship, and which becomes a huge key element of that whole story.
Call here from Robin in St. Paul. Hey, Robin, hi. Hope you're enjoying the music.
Until this song that's playing now, because when he died, I went immediately to remembering him sitting with my mother. And as I listen to the conversation and as we celebrate his gift, I'm so thankful to Sheila E. for reminding us that his gift and his gift of giving back to his community, his gift of loving his people, as we talk about the ownership of his gift, will those who own his gift remember his commitment to the organizations that serve his people? I had an opportunity to attend the University of Minnesota's bestowing upon him the honorary doctorate, where we were reminded of Prince's commitment to community and to young people. We were reminded of his quote, if we do not own our masters, the master owns us. We have to. And just hearing you, sir, talk about being uncomfortable and hearing that song, I mean, we have to keep that in front of folks. Was he ready for us to hear those things? I'm teared up because he loved the mothers of the village. He loved his community. And it's so unfortunate that we have to wonder, was he ready for us to hear these things? But what I have a plea that as we figure all of it out and as more things are released, and as more visitors visit his home and his place of creating the gift, that we do not forget what he was passionate about, giving back to communities, giving back to people, giving back to young people, being a vision of possibilities for young people. He was committed to helping young people not get caught up in this mess that we are in for such a time as this. He was for such a time as this, man, activist, artist. We cannot lose that in all of this. So whoever's owning it, be it family, be it whomever, we have to honor him.
Robin, did I hear you say that you were at the ceremony? Because for the honorary
ceremony.
Yeah. Zahir, I think you were there too.
Yes.
Did I see that?
Well.
What was it like?
It was bittersweet. You know, this was something that they had begun planning to do while he was still with us. And my understanding is when he heard about it, his response was, cool. So, you know, this would have been something that he would have been here. And I think Prince was entering this phase of his life and his career where he was this elder statesman of music, both for the reasons that Robin has talked about in terms of his looking after the issues affecting communities, but also the way that he wanted to mentor younger artists, mm-hmm. whether it be people like Janelle Monáe or others. And, you know, I think he was entering that phase where he would receive these kinds of awards and recognitions also because a lot of the people who are in positions to bestow those things grew up on his music and were now in positions to recognize him in this way. So it was bittersweet. And I think a few of the speakers there talked about how this was their love letter to him, you know, in respect of the way that he upheld and celebrated Minnesota and Minneapolis and certainly the local communities that birthed him. You know, this was something that he did not forget. And, you know, one of the interesting things about in that performance of 17 Days that's on this release, he does this, you know, he says this lyric, you know, I know you're holding another, and he says N-word. He's like, I know you're holding another N-word tight. And I thought that was interesting because this release, you know, this was recorded on the cusp of his Purple Rain, where people began to speculate about his racial identity, and he may have participated in that speculation. Was he white? Was he black? Was he mixed? Was he this? Was he that? And in this performance of 17 Days, he like admits that, and it's very clear that I am in the black community, and I know you're holding another person tight that's in the black community. Mm-hmm. And I think he situated himself very early on, and certainly in his final days among us, very squarely in the black community and concerned about the issues affecting not just the black community, but everyone else as well.
Walter called to say, I remember the scene from Purple Rain where Prince goes to the basement and he finds his dad's old music. And it kind of reminds me of this situation and us finding his music. I think he wanted us to find it. And to Nikki mm-hmm. in Eden Prairie. Hi, Nikki. Thanks for waiting.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So what are you thinking about? What's your question?
So my question is, you know, obviously beyond the music, there are motivations, you know, such as money and things that come from the release of those songs. And I'm kind of curious about who would be profiting from those and if there's a financial aspect to those recordings.
I've wondered about this, too. Jim, do you know anything about that?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the music business in 2018-19 is not as profitable as it was in the 1980s. No release that comes out is going to sell millions of copies. It's I don't know where the estate is at. I know they have a big tax bill that they're going to have to deal with, and there's issues with Paisley Park and with maintaining that as an enterprise. There's a lot of speculation on the business side. So, you know, the thing, when he was with us, he could generate money by going on the road,
mm-hmm.
kind
mm-hmm.
of at the snap of a fingers. You know, he could, and he often did it at the snap of a fingers. Like, I'm going to play a 20,000 seat venue in 3 days, and he could sell it out.
Is that right that he would make
unique.
A decision like that at the last yeah. minute, and they'd pull it together?
Yeah.
Wow.
But now that revenue stream is gone. So I don't know all the details on the financials, but I don't think that this type of releases it can be looked at as something that's going to be netting tens of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Zahir and Jim, we got a tweet from Sean who says, "Will we ever be able to stop with the seemingly never-ending shows about Prince?" Sean, I will say it's been more than a year since I've done a show about Prince, but I take your point. He says it's been 2.5 years. Minnesotans still can't seem to move on. I can't be alone in thinking enough is enough. Find a new topic. Jim,
I mean,
Jim has to speak to this.
This release was a big story, whether it's, you know, whatever you want to look at, Rolling Stone, the New York Times, this was covered. This wasn't just covered in Minnesota.
Right.
And I know that as long as you see artists like, you know, Zahir mentioned Janelle Monáe, who Prince was an early supporter and longtime supporter, is, you know, she's had almost maybe the record of the year, and she is a huge acolyte of Prince. Kendrick Lamar, a huge fan. I mean, I got an email yesterday from a major rock band that's coming to town saying, hey, do you got a hookup at Paisley Park? The band wants to go take a tour when they come to town. It's I don't know that we'll anytime soon
stop talking about
Prince, especially when you get this kind of music coming out. Like
Zahir,
we've only just begun. if Minnesota doesn't want Prince, all I have to say is all the critics love you in New York. You know, we'll take him.
And you say it's only just begun because there's so much more music to come out of the vault. Do you guys?
It's so much more music, and you know, we have only just begun to unpack what Prince's meaning is, even beyond the music, to his community, to the moment. I mean, so much of Prince and his public persona and his music aligned with important streams of historical movements throughout the latter part of the 20th century, whether it's post-civil rights, whether it's feminism, whether it's, you know, emergent sexual identities and gender identity. And I mean, we still have to grapple with the full meaning and significance of who Prince is.
We're going to play Mary Don't You Weep here to close, and I want to let as much of it roll as we possibly can. Zahir, say something about this song and what you hear when you hear it, when you listen.
You know, we knew that Prince had a little church in him, and this is where we get to really hear it. You know, this is Prince tapping into a deep spiritual tradition in black music, something that he would revisit in a song like Avalanche, which was in his own solo piano released in 2002. What's interesting about this song is that halfway it changes from a spiritual about hope to a interpersonal longing for a lost relationship, because the song is really directed about, you know, it's rooted in the story of Lazarus's two sisters, Mary and Martha, who are mourning his death because he hasn't been resurrected yet in the Bible. And then at halfway into the song, Prince says, you know, he's going from like, he's coming. Don't moan. Don't cry. Don't weep. But then like halfway through the song, he's like, your man ain't coming home. And then he transforms Mary and Martha into these essentially love interests. You know, one who's cooking him breakfast, omelets, and another one who he says, you know, I like your shh. And he silences himself because he knows what he's saying. And so this is Prince mixing the spiritual and the carnal, you know, his merging of the sacred and the, I guess, profane, which was something that he would embody throughout most of his career.
Zahir, what a pleasure. Thank you. Let me know when you're in town next. I hope we can talk again.
Certainly.
Jim, thank you.
Absolutely.
Bad feeling. that your man ain't coming home. Yeah. Oh, mother, yeah, you cook the greatest omelets in the world, Mary, don't you moan, yeah. I've got that bad feeling, your man.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.